Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Continuing, Atra Samvyavaharikam Iti Sarvatrikam Eva Vyavaharikam Iti Gayam. Quachid Upamardasya Darshitatwad Eva Shastratva Vyavaharaha Drishyate Chanyatra Suryadi Mandalasya Sukshmataya Pratyakshi Kritir Api Anumana Shabdabhyam Badita Bhavati Iti Durasta Vastunas Tadrishataya Drishtatvat Shastra Prasidatvat Cha. The reference here to the word Samvyavaharikam. Let's go back to what Vajaspati Mishra said. Nacha tasyotpadakam. No. Nahi agamagyanam samvyavaharakam patyakshasha pramanyam upahanti. Scriptural evidence does not defeat the ordinary authority of sensory perception. So samvyavaharikam means the ordinary authority. Samvyavaharikam pramanyam. Because vyavahara is his business, material business, affairs in the material world. And then we have a prefix sam. So some discussion now about what that means. What does the word samvyavaharikam really mean here? Translation, here in Vachasmati Mishra's statement, the word ordinary or samvyavaharika should be understood to refer to that which is relevant anywhere and everywhere. Okay. What's in use everywhere is samvyavaharikam. In the spiritual world, there are special situations. But in the material world, it's ordinary. So it's the ordinary use, the ordinary authority of pratyaksha is not denied by shabda. Pratyaksha can go about its ordinary business, but it's not fit in its by itself to give to reveal the absolute truth. And we can use the ordinary shabda in its ordinary power to let us have access to the shabda by hearing it and understanding it. That's just the samvyavaharika authority, the ordinary authority of pratyaksha. We let that, we don't deny that, and we use it to get access to shabda. Okay, continuing here. And scripture is commonly known as shastra because it is seen in particular cases to engage in overruling. Upamardasya darshitatvat. Upamarda, to trample somebody from above. Or to overrule. So, therefore, it's called shastra. Shastra is ruling power. Ruling because shastra says it's so-and-so, and everybody else who says otherwise is wrong. Shastra overrules sometimes. Continuing, elsewhere than in Vachaspati's statement, That means in other contexts, other than this paragraph by Vajaspati, we see that both inference and scriptural evidence refute the sensory perception that the sun globe or some other celestial body is very small. Look in the sky, how big does the sun look? That's small. Smaller than a small coin. That is refuted by scriptural evidence in Anuman. Because from observation one has learned that far away things appear like that. So we have observation, experience, repeated experience. The things are bigger than they seem when they're farther away. Something far away is not as big, it doesn't look as big as it actually is. And then we draw a rule that far away things look smaller than they are. That's our hetu. So the sun is not as small as it looks because far away things are bigger than they look. As, for example, all these other examples. The experience I've had in my life. I know my brother is taller than me, but when he's far away, he looks smaller than me. But he's not. So based on such experiences, I draw the generalization that things far away, in general, are bigger than they look to be. And also, because this understanding is established from the scriptures. There's a period missing here at the end of the sentence, okay? Insert, comment. Sorry, I just had to make a note about the missing period. Comment, short commentary. Vajaspati Mishra referred above to the authority of sensory perception as samvyavaharika, which can be translated as useful in ordinary dealings. Okay, any problems with that? All right, moving on. Tadevam stite. Sri Vaishnavas, thus being so. So what's being so is that we've affirmed that Shabda Praman is independent and it's not overruled by contrary evidence of the senses. It stands unrefuted, even when the senses tell us otherwise. It doesn't depend on sensory perception. Tadevam stite Sri Vaishnavas tu evam vadanti. Vedasya na prakrita pratyakshadi vad avidya vad vishaya matra tvena yavad eva vidya tavad eva tadvyavaharaha. Sativyavahare pramanyam cheti mantavyam aparusheya tvat nitya tvat. Sarva muktyeka kala bhavena tad adhikarinam santatasti tvat parameshwara prasadena parameshwara vad eva vidyati nam chitchaktyeka vibhavanam atmaramanam parshadanam api brahm anando parichara bhakti paramanandina samadhi parayanadir Darshayishyamana Twat Srimat Parameshwara Parameshwarasya Swaveda Maryadam Avalambyaiva Muhuk Shrishtyadi Pavartika Twat Cha. That's a long sentence. Here's the translation. Hold on a second. Okay, the Vedas, unlike mundane sensory perception and so on, do not have only material illusion as their subject. Thus, it is not that the Vedas can be useful only within a realm of illusion and have authority only within that range of usefulness. Now, who would say such a thing? Mayavadis, The absolute truth cannot be described in words. The Vedas are words. They cannot actually describe the absolute truth directly. And so whatever the Vedas say is illusory, describe as illusory. The Mayavadis, they may not like to come out and say it, but that's the conclusion of their theory. The Vedas just talk about Maya. Well, we're denying that here. The Vedas have no human author. They are eternal. Notice how I split the sentence up into small sentences. They are eternal. Suitable persons are always present to study them, because at no point does everyone become liberated at one time. No. If you could argue that if you're liberated, you don't need to study the Vedas. But there's always someone around who's not liberated. You know, it's not everyone's liberated all at once. And there's no people left to read the Vedas. It will also be shown that even the Supreme Lord's companions, who by his grace have become transcendental to illusion like the Lord himself, who are endowed with purely spiritual opulences, and who are satisfied within themselves, still recite the Sama and the other Vedas in the great ecstasy of devotional service. Ecstasy superior even to the bliss of merging with Brahman. And the divine personality of Godhead conforms to the regulations of his own Vedas when he repeatedly engages in such acts as creating the universe. There is a blueprint or a plan, description of how creation is done. And the Supreme Lord, although he's completely independent, he follows that plan. He doesn't go against the Vedas and do things other than they are described in the Vedas. That's his choice. And then going back to the Sanskrit for the next part. Yesham tu purusha jnana kalpitam eva vedadikam sarvam dvaitam tesham aparusheyatva bhavat tata eva brahmadi sambhavat swapna pralapavad vyavahara siddhavapi pramanyam nopapadyate iti tanmatam avaidika vishesha iti. Now getting back at the Mayavadis. But there are those who think that the Vedas, like all else in duality, are concocted by human intelligence. Oh, the Mayavadis won't say that, but there are people who say that. Mayavadis will say the Vedas, but the Vedas are also duality. But they won't say that they're created by humans. But there are people who have no faith in the Vedic authority and say it was just written by human beings. Materialists say that. There are those who think that the Vedas, like all else in duality, are concocted by human intelligence, not free from human authorship and open to faults like delusion. The Vedas are. To such persons, the Vedas have no more authority, even in establishing ordinary matters, than the incoherent things said in a dream. The viewpoint of such persons is but another form of disbelief in the Vedas. Commentary? Ramanuja's devotees call themselves the Sri Sampradaya because they always worship the Supreme Lord Narayan along with Sri, his eternal consort, the original founder of their Sampradaya. Their opinions, summarized here in the discussion on the authority of the Vedas, are distinct from the views of impersonalists like Vachaspati Mishra. Although the Vedas may be called impersonal in the sense that they were never composed by anyone, the Sri Vaishnavas see in the Vedas abundant glorification of the personality of Godhead, his transcendental abode, his devotees, and devotional service. So this is the Sri Vaishnav view on the authority of the Vedas. Especially since great liberated devotees also take pleasure in reciting the Vedas. If the Vedas only dealt with material topics, why would they be interested in the Vedas or in reciting them? And why would the Supreme Lord himself choose to conform to the descriptions of the Vedas? He doesn't have to. But the Vedas are purely spiritual. That's why. And people who say the Vedas are just a human creation, they're just atheists. Okay, any questions on that much? Yes, Bruce.
I have two questions. So, in the sentence, suitable persons are always present to study them because at no point does everyone become liberated at one time. So yes. The suitable person is those who want liberation?
Yeah, mumukshus. Or no, is it only people who want liberation who study the Vedas?
No.
People who want something material also study the Vedas if they have faith in the Vedas. They may still be materialistic, but they have faith in the Vedas. So those people also. But if everyone's liberated, if everyone goes off to Vaikuntha or merges into Nirvana, then there's no more candidates.
They don't.
Apparently, there's no more candidates for the Vedas.
But a liberated person doesn't need to study the Vedas.
Well, let's see, who's saying that? Sri Vaishnavas are saying it, but they're saying that someone else is saying it. I'm looking at the Sanskrit here. Sorry. Okay, how are you formulating the question?
Because they say that the Vedas have no human author, they are eternal, and then they seem to give like a reason why they are eternal. Suitable persons are always present to study them.
No, that's not a reason why they're eternal. That's not the logic.
No. Okay, but still, the question still stands.
Always has adhikars.
Adhikars, but they say the reasons why there's always adhikars because at no point does everyone become liberated at one time. So they present as if the Vedas is just for persons that are not liberated.
Well, a doubting person might think that the Vedas are only useful if you have conditioned souls who need the Vedas. So if you grant that to have any purpose, the Vedas need some audience of conditioned souls, even if you assume that, there always will be such an audience. Everybody isn't going to get liberated all at once. And then he says, even liberated souls are also part of the audience anyway. So that's only granted hypothetically. You know, if someone thinks that you need conditioned souls, otherwise the Vedas don't have any purpose, there's no audience. Okay, but there always are conditioned souls. And anyway, even liberated souls like to listen to the Vedas. Yes?
But if other people have questions on this subject, then...
Well... Okay, let Madam Mohan ask his, and I'll go back to you.
Maybe it is an argument against Mayavadis, because if Mayavadis hold that everything is one, and if any of them ever got liberated, then there would have been no Mayavadis, and there would have been no need to study the Vedas, because Vedas, according to them, grant liberation.
Well, that creates some problems, if you think that out. That because not the way, there are some Mayavadis who present Ekajiva Vad, uh-huh. But that's sort of a you know, extreme view. There's only one jiva.
It's consistent view, not extreme. I think it's
right.
Clear.
But I think many Mayavadis would rather avoid that.
Yeah.
Because it's apparent that there are more than one jivas, and that there are some people in the past who got liberation, and there's other people left who didn't get liberation. You know, if you accept the empiric evidence, there is more than one jiva, and they're not all liberated yet. Once some of them got liberated in the past, scriptures say that. And we have history, you know, that so-and-so in our line was a liberated soul, and then we got disciples around now who aren't liberated. So the Ekajivavad is inconsistent with obvious empiric evidence. And if you life becomes more complicated if liberation is one soul at a time.
Yeah, and then the other option for them would be a theory of kind of piecemeal liberation of Bhagavan. Yeah,
one at a time.
Yeah, and then you have to.
It's like you got all these little pieces of Brahman in Maya. You have to recover them one by one.
Yeah, but you have to get them all together, so he snaps back into whole piece and then becomes liberated Bhagavan again. But it's an endless process because
it's an endless process.
So in other words, both ways it refutes my about philosophy. So I was thinking maybe it's a speculation, but looks like this is an indication, this argument, that there are always suitable persons to study them, and this indirectly, tangentially refutes the theory of Ekajivavada because...
Well, okay, but that's not the topic. That's not the topic in this paragraph.
He was referring to Mayavada interpretation before that.
Anyway, this paragraph is not arguing against the Mayavadis in particular. This is the viewpoint of the Sri Vaishnavas. You know, they've got, you know, objections with the Mayavadis, but they're not only fighters with the Mayavadis. They have something of their own to say, and that's what this paragraph is.
I'm just wondering if this particular argument is targeted in some roundabout way against
maybe
Mayavadis.
Maybe in a roundabout way.
If it's taken
maybe a roundabout way, but it's not. There's no mention of Mayavadis here.
Not explicitly. I understand that, but maybe it's taken in the context of Shri Sampradaya statements might have been in an argument against Mayavad philosophy somewhat. Anyway, just curious.
You see, what this is supporting is the idea that there's always adhikaris. There's always an audience for the Vedas. That's the point that's being made here by the Sri Vaishnavas. The Vedas, there's no question of the Vedas being purposeless because they always have an audience. They always have an audience because not everybody gets liberated all at once. There's always someone left unliberated. Yes.
There was a similar question, like Mahaprabhu asks Haridas Thakur, what will happen when all the living entities will be liberated, and Haridas Thakur says that there will be more coming from Yoga Nidra.
From
Narayana, who are the sleeping souls, they'll again
no,
populate the
universe. No, not from Narayana. As somebody says, where do they come from? Where? Not from Brahman. What does the book say? What does Haridas Thakur actually say? Where do they come from? Where were they sleeping? In a hotel?
In the body of Narayana.
Where?
I'm sorry.
No, not in the body of Mahavishnu. What he says is that they're sleeping inside the atoms. That there's jivas in every atom. Jivas, there's so many jivas waiting to take birth. There's no room for all of them. They don't have enough bodies. So those who are on the waiting list, they have to sit inside atoms. But they can't do anything. They're not, no active consciousness. They're dormant. But where they're dormant, where they're sleeping, is inside the atoms. Every atom's got a jiva. So all the extra jivas have to wait inside atoms. And then if you clear out the whole universe, then the ones who are sitting in the atoms, they can take their place. Some of them. There's still not enough room. You could do it over and over again, and still there'd be more left.
And our liberated...
That's what Haridas Thakur told them.
And our liberated souls singing the Vedas. In Brahma Samhita, we find that Samprapya Rupa Mahimasana Yana Bhusha Suktair Yameva Nigama Pratitaihi Stuvanti Govindamadi Purushanayama.
Meaning?
the living entities, after attaining, after being situated in their original opulence, that is back to Godhead when they go.
No, I don't think that describes back to Godhead. It describes heavenly opulences.
No. It's,
okay, what does it say? You got the translation?
I adore the same Govinda, the primeval Lord, in whose praise men who are imbued with devotion sing the mantra suktas told by the Vedas. By gaining their appropriate beauty, greatness, thrones, conveyances, and ornaments, and in the purport, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj writes, Shanta or unattached, in discussing rasa, we meet with five kinds of devotion or service. Shanta or unattached, dasya or pertaining to reverential willing service, sakhya, vatsalya, and shringara.
Mm-hmm.
The devotee is surcharged with the ideas of their respective service. Serve Krishna eternally and ultimately reach the goal of their respective ideals. They attain the real nature of their self, befitting their respective rasas, their glories, conveyances, seats, befitting their sacred service and transcendental qualities of ornaments, enhancing the beauty of their real nature.
Oh, okay. All right, and what are you going to make out of that?
Yeah, that means it's referring to people who have gone back home, back to Godhead, and they are
still chanting the Vedas.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Okay. Go ahead.
Then after speaking this argument against the Mayavadis, he says, but there are those who think that the Vedas...
But this is not against the Mayavadis. Where?
But there are those who think that the Vedas are... Like,
yeah, but I don't think that what was before that was directly against the Mayavadis.
Okay. But establishing the Vedas as eternal. But then he says that...
There are disbelievers, atheists.
Yeah, but he doesn't give any arguments against this? There's no argument for that? He just says...
Well, it's just dismissed that this is atheism. That means you don't believe in the authority of the Vedas. If you say everything, the Vedas were written by human beings and you have no faith in them, and then, you know, what are we going to argue about? Okay, you don't believe.
So he doesn't...
Well, you're an atheist. We'll leave it at that.
But doesn't give counter-arguments against... It's a question of believing or not.
You
believe that this was written by no human author, or you don't believe?
If you think the Vedas... The seed of an argument is here. If you think this ordinary human being wrote the Vedas, then the faults of your ordinary human beings, Brahma Adi, are not free from, the Vedas aren't free from those faults. Then the Vedas are not authoritative. They're just speculations of human beings. So what are we wasting our time with the Vedas for? If you're right, then we have no business with the Vedas. Anyway, you have no business with the Vedas. Why don't you go somewhere else?
We won't entertain any argument.
No need arguing with atheists. They won't accept the authority of the Vedas. Okay, you have a right to your opinion.
Yes. I just recently heard Srila Prabhupada in one class says, he explains about the Vedas. Vedas say there are 14 planetary systems, and he names them all. So if you like, you can accept. Otherwise, it's your right to reject. And Prabhupada went on speaking.
Your right to reject, yeah.
Yeah,
so. There's no grounds for further discussion in that case. What are you going to tell them? What would you say? If someone says, I don't believe in the Vedas, what are you going to tell them? You can try to convince them, common sense. Well, you're going to die, you know. What are you going to do about that?
Yeah.
Everyone's born is going to die. Can you deny that? Vedas or no Vedas? What are you going to do about it?
There's a purport somewhere that Prabhupada says that most people now these days don't accept the authority of the Vedas, so one should preach with argument and logic.
Yeah, okay. You can still talk to them, but not serious philosophy, just common sense. Yasya na dharma dharmao nasa samayi. This is Madhvacharya, Vishnu Tattva Vinirnaya. Someone who doesn't have a proper concept of dharma and adharma, he's not a person to engage in a serious philosophical discussion with. He's not a samayi. He has no right in joining a serious philosophical discussion. then you're talking with an infant, you know. And you gotta, you know, you can talk some simple common sense, but you can't talk serious philosophy. Of Dharma or Adharma? Yes. Madan Mohan?
I just want to ask you about, it looks like in this commentary, excuse me, in the translation here, it says, the Vedas do not have only material illusion as their subject. It is thus not that they can be useful only within the realm of illusion. It sounds strikingly similar to what Buddhists hold about the nature of reality in general. It looks like if it is indeed a quotation from Mayavadis, then they have just transferred the Buddhist concept onto the Vedas themselves, and they try to judge the Vedas by the concept of useful practicality. Is it correct?
As Prabhupada says, the Buddhists at least are honest. They come out and say they don't believe in the Vedas. The Mayavadis are cheaters because they pretend to accept the authority of the Vedas. But then if you follow their logic, the Vedas have no authority. They only deal with illusion, with duality. But they don't come out and say that because they're pretending to be proponents of the Vedas. So they're not going to say that, although it's implied by what they do say. The Buddhists could come out and say this. Yes.
My question is that looks like if we take this as a definition, Mayavadi's take on the Vedas, then judging by the...
No, I don't think we should. No straight-thinking Mayavadi would come out and say this.
Well, we might
because it makes them out to be atheists, to be non-believers in the authority of the Vedas. They can't do that. They can't openly do. They got to pretend that they do believe in the Vedas. So the Mayavadi would not say this.
Well, we have to make them say that. If they're hard pressed and cornered, they have to admit one or the other. Either take it as literal and emanation from God Himself, or else they should just admit themselves to be atheists. One of the two.
So you want to go out and get some Mayavadis and put them in a corner?
We had plenty in Russia. I just want to ask you, it looks like if we take this in face value and then we refer to Vachaspati's own statement about oyster and silver, like silver and oyster, an oyster cancels out the previous assumption that it was silver.
Okay.
So then if we apply this to here and the Mayavadis accept practical usefulness, as the ultimate criteria for judging the Vedas, then they believe as in practical usefulness as an ultimate reality, more ultimate than the Vedas themselves, because that's what makes them able to judge the Vedas' validity.
Yes.
So in other words, they're just basically...
But Mayavadis won't do that. They won't. They presume the Vedas to be authoritative.
We can do
even
that.
Though there's contradictions. They say other things that undermine the authority of the Vedas, but their presumption, their axiom is that the Vedas are authoritative. Only other people will come out and say the Vedas are not authoritative, but Mayavadi won't do that.
But that was one of the techniques of our acharyas.
They'll point out the inconsistencies. It's implied by the things they say, but they wouldn't come out and say this directly.
So we should do that for them.
Yes?
We should do that for them.
Yeah, sure.
And looks like... ask you. Anyway, I lost my mind. There's something else I wanted to ask you.
Anyway, just bring a Mayavadi tomorrow morning, so try it out on him. Yes.
Since we are discussing what other people have to say about the Vedas, I just was wondering, as you mentioned, Mayavadis accepted axiomatically that Vedas are the authority.
Yes.
On what grounds? What makes them convinced in that? Because what makes convinced us is that Vedas are breathing of Lord Narayana, and it's the law's own form, and also.
By definition, an axiom is something that you don't have a reason for. You got to start with something. You can't just be tracing back infinitely reason for this and then reason for that. You have an infinite regress. So you got to start with something you assume without a reason.
It's one of their basic
assumptions. It's a basic, we believe. It's our credo that the Vedas are authoritative, no, without a reason.
So like this, they say,
yeah,
without explaining.
I don't
more
think so. I never read it. Little I read of Shankaracharya's works, any argument why the Vedas are authoritative, because their brothers in disguise, the Buddhists, deny the authority of the Vedas and come up with about the same philosophy. So it's not crucial to the philosophy for the Vedas to be authoritative. You just have to go about it a different means. I mean, they use the Vedas. They quote from the Upanishads right and left to prove their Advaitavad. So their whole tradition falls apart if you lose the authority of the Vedas, their whole literary tradition. They got to start from scratch with new arguments. Or just become Buddhists.
So, in this
so they have a need. They're dependent on the Vedas because their whole, you know, their whole methodology is to cite the authority of the Vedas.
So in this relation, we are not as dogmatic as them because we have more reasons to accept Vedas.
Yes. Let's see. We have, yeah, well, that's what Jiva Goswami is trying to do here, give reasons why to accept the authority of the Vedas. We're tracing it back. We're not just saying, believe it or else. Believe it or go to hell. No, we're not saying it. We're trying to give some reasons. Yes.
What I wanted to ask you about, in the 10th canto there is a chapter, Shruti's prayers, and Parikshit Maharaj asks this very question of Shukadeva Goswami, saying that how can the Vedas, which are composed of material sounds...
They're made out of words.
Excuse me?
They're made of words.
Material sounds, eventually.
Yes.
And how can they bring about liberation of a person? So in other words, if you ask this question of a Mayavadi...
How can they reveal the absolute truth that is beyond words?
With Mayic words. In other words,
yes.
Where do Vedas really belong? If they belong to the realm of transcendence, then we as conditioned souls cannot have any access, not more than to Bhagavan himself. Or if they belong to our realm of Mayic, well, then how can they reach... How, by using them as means, we can reach transcendence?
Well, this is your question.
So this
That question is not discussed in the prayers of personified Vedas, but it's an interesting question.
It's a question which Parikshit Maharaj asks of Shukadeva Goswami, basically. I just kind of fluffed it up a little bit.
Well, he's asking, how can the Vedas describe the absolute truth? They're made of words. Words are duality. And duality can't contact the transcendence. But you're talking about, what about us?
No.
If we're in the material realm, how can the absolute, if the Vedas are absolute, how can we access the Vedas? That's another question.
No, it's the same question, basically, because it's talking about Vedas as a bridge between the two, us and Bhagavan. And Parikshit Maharaj is asking about the same. But my question is...
Parikshit's asking it the other way around.
Yeah.
He's asking, if the Vedas are material, how can they contact the absolute? Now you're adding, if the Vedas are spiritual, how can we material people access the Vedas? It's an interesting question, but it's not there in Parikshit's question.
Well, my question is about, if we take Parikshit Maharaj's question first and apply it to Mayavadis and
yes.
Vaishnavas, how both of the parties answered, Mayavadis and Vaishnavas?
Mayavadis are in the corner, because you can ask him, are the Vedas made of words? Yes. Aren't words a kind of duality? Yes. Then can the Vedas actually directly describe things beyond duality? No. Then they've admitted that the Vedas are not really authoritative. But they'd only do that under duress. Yeah, if you get them in the corner. Anyway, immediately, Shukadev's answer, and especially when he starts reciting the prayers of the personified Vedas, is that the Vedas can describe the absolute. The Shrutis, at least sometimes, do directly describe the personality of Godhead and his energies. They do. That's the answer. Is that the Vedas are spiritual words. There's a difference between material words and spiritual words. Spiritual words can describe the transcendence. They do.
Not only can they describe the transcendence, but they describe the transcendence in such a way that we, conditioned souls, can hear and relate to it, and that spiritual experience
yes.
gets transmitted
okay.
to us.
Okay.
That's the whole point.
That's your part of the question. How can we, as material conditioned souls, access the transcendental Vedas? Well, the Vedas are via medium. They're not only spiritual, but they communicate to conditioned souls. They have the power to do that. course, Krishna's other spiritual energies also have such similar powers. To, you know, the Vaikuntha Vasis can come down and give help to conditioned souls who are not aware of it. They have power to contact or to affect our lives, even to affect our consciousness, the other energies. So especially the Vedas, that's their special power. To not only have contact with the Absolute Truth, but to convey, to deliver the Absolute Truth to even bewildered conditioned souls. They have the power to enlighten souls in ignorance. Sometimes it's a difficult process and they have to go a roundabout way of accomplishing it, but it can be done. Enlightening deluded souls. That's the power of the Vedas. It's like Agni is a devata. I think he's considered to be influenced by the mode of ignorance because he eats old garbage. Yeah. But he's the via medium. He conveys the offerings of the human beings to the demigods. He goes in between. So the Vedas also go in between. They convey the enlightenment of the spiritual world to the material world. Yes.
If I remember correctly, after that, Shukadev Goswami, to answer this question of Parikshit Maharaj, he says that he starts from far away. He says that Krishna creates, or the Supreme Personality of God creates different senses, and because of those senses she creates, we can perceive this world. So otherwise this world would have been as inapproachable for us as transcendence for us.
Yes.
From that point of view, there is no difference between the two, because it's him who gives us a perception. For both, and since he can give us perception of the material world, he can also give us perception of the spiritual world.
Well, that's
world.
Not only implied; it's part of the statement. Mm-hmm. He gives us our senses and mind and intelligence for material enjoyment, for elevation to heavenly planets, also for liberation. Akalpanaya cha. So the senses and mind can be used to achieve liberation and regain the transcendence, and that's done by the enlightenment of the Shrutis.
And Prabhupada says that ultimately this question can only be answered meaningfully if we accept that Krishna is the Absolute Truth as a person, because if he is impersonal, then there is no hope to access him through any sound, any means, because he cannot outreach his hand to us.
Doesn't have a hand.
He doesn't have a hand,
How the Mayavadis can justify their accepting the authority of the Vedas. First of all, they would charge us of a circular kind of a thinking, because when we say that we accept the Vedas because they are the breathing of Narayana, so then they'll say that the deity, Narayana, you came to know about him from the Vedas. So if that forms your reason to accept the Vedas, but that reason is mentioned in the Vedas itself, so...
Circular. Not only that, but according to you, Mayavadis, Narayana is Maya. It's Ishvara. Ishvara is a form of illusion.
Yeah.
So where's the authority? You know, for them, it's the breathing of an illusion.
For them, that illusion is more refined than the gross illusion.
Better illusion is still illusion. Still so Maya.
It can still.
It's the breathing of Maya. We have reasons, yeah.
For ourselves, first of all.
Yes.
Then Mayavadis have their reasons to accept Vedas for themselves, for their own sake.
Do they have reasons to accept the Vedas? Why should they accept the Vedas? Say, why not? Isn't it simpler just to be a Buddhist?
Yes.
Deny the Vedas? You know, isn't that simpler? What do you, you know, what's this? How can you justify accepting the authority of Vedas? Why?
Because
why is that your authority? Why not, you know, a comic book? What's so special about the Vedas?
That's a higher
Vedas
level.
They come from the breathing of an illusion.
That's a higher level of reality than what we are now. So, although that's not the ultimate reality, so we can be benefited.
I like Shakespeare. Time. You know, he's pretty high. Why not take Shakespeare as my authority? He's better than, you know, he's smarter than me. I can understand a few of the things he says. So maybe I should take him as my authority. And then the Mayavadis don't have a good reason for accepting the authority of the Vedas, except for a tradition. But the tradition only goes back to Shankaracharya. You go back further than that, the impersonalists, the Buddhists, weren't accepting the authority of the Vedas. And then Shankaracharya steps in and pushes the Vedas back in. But that's a new thing. Where do you get that from? You know, all the impersonalists centuries before Shankaracharya were denying the authority of the Vedas. All of a sudden he comes around and tells us to accept the Vedas again. Why? And then he presents a theory that undermines the authority of the Vedas. It doesn't allow them to describe any absolute truth.
I remember one argument of Mayavadi, what they speak about Vedas, that they use this logic of Chandra Shaka Nyaya. Like we have moon in the sky and we have this tree, and if you want to point to the moon, we have to first point to the tree, branches of tree, and then between branches of tree we can see the moon. So in the same way they tell that Vedas, they are some indication to absolute truth, and we can accept them because they lead us to absolute truth. But finally, one of the explanation which they give, that if you follow Vedas, if you do this this practice of meditation and so on, austerities, so finally this absolute truth, they call it Brahman, they will give knowledge.
Any proposition that has any element of truth in it also points toward the absolute truth. Okay, the Vedas point in the right direction toward the truth. What about, you know, the books of Karl Marx? You know, they're also pointing to the truth. Why not accept them as authority? More down to earth, deals with, you know, things of substance, economics, real problems. Why not be a Marxist?
I think finally they give argument that there are few people who achieved liberation by following Vedas. And because of that, they can tell that Vedas are authority, because by following Vedas, human being also can achieve liberation.
Uh-huh. They present that argument?
I think so. Okay. I don't remember.
Okay, well, it makes sense. Okay, there are people who attained liberation by following the Vedas, therefore the Vedas should be followed.
Yeah. At least they accept the authority of Shankaracharya. They tell that Shankara, he is a liberated soul, and by following Vedas, he...
Well, okay, at least Shankara is telling us.
Yeah.
You know, here's the way to get liberation. You know, you should study the Vedas and do this and that. And part of it is studying the Vedas. So he presents it as part of the sadhana, study the Vedas. But that's just the hearsay, Shankara told us to do this.
So finally, why did he do it?
Why did he reestablish the authority of the Vedas? What was his justification and what was his real motive?
I also remember one explanation that actually they put this liberated souls above Vedas. They tell that only one achieved this level which is higher. Yes. Then Vedas is so, because Vedas in some ways, Chandra Shakanyai is like a medium, but absolute truth is beyond.
So liberated souls have no use for the Vedas.
Yeah, so, and they tell that only those people who are above, who are on this highest level of,
yes,
of Brahman, they can descend and they can explain Vedas as they are. Therefore, they put into absolute not Vedas, as an absolute authority, but these liberated souls who achieved liberation,
yes,
like Shankaracharya and so,
yes,
and many others.
Okay.
So, actually, they deny Vedas in some way.
Okay, so it's the opinions of liberated souls that can be given as a reason to accept the Vedas. Something. But still, they're... Once they get to work, the Mayavadis undermine the authority of the Vedas.
And we also, in some way, believe that we can understand Vedas only by the means of a disciple succession, by the means of we can get a correct interpretation of Vedas only by the mercy of spiritual master,
yes,
only through Guru Parampara. In some
so
way,
they're very orthodox, the Mayavadis, following Shankara. They insist on the authority of the Vedas. They insist on the need of Guru Parampara and becoming a faithful disciple. But they're hypocrites because they contradict their premises. They don't actually follow the Vedas and they actually end up denying the Vedic authority.
Yeah, because in our case we put Krishna as an ultimate authority and our Guru Parampara comes from Krishna and we accept Krishna's words as an authority, like he told it in Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam.
Yes, and so what you have is no real disciplic succession. In modern times, you have this Neo-Vedanta. You got people claiming to be coming in the line of Shankara. They have no real connection. They're not practicing the sadhana that Shankara gave. They're not following his line of reasoning. They're coming up with all sorts of crazy ideas and calling it Vedanta. But this really is not follow. They're not actually following their own parampara. Their own parampara, they're not following. The Neo-Vedanta, New Vedantas. Like Vivekananda and these guys and more recent, you know, they're not even following Shankara. Philosophically or in practice, in their practice.
I remember one of such a people, Sri Aurobindo, for example, he also was accepting Vedas, but he told in a few places that Krishna had made a mistake in Bhagavad Gita. He corrected Bhagavad Gita.
Oh, okay.
So they put this realization of such a soul as a ultimate authority, which is above all shastras, just this experience.
So ultimately, what they believe in is the current guru who happens to be, you know, the absolute truth himself. That's it. It's just a personality cult. And each guru is pretending to be the absolute truth. Yes, okay, last thing. Yeah.
And I think that Shankara correctly asked, Chaitanya Charitamrita Srila Prabhupada goes at length in one purport explaining how Shankara actually correcting Vyasadeva himself.
I don't remember exactly what that was, but yeah.
It's like vague in my memory. But
yeah. Lakshmana is complaining that Shankara thinks that Vyasadeva was Bhranta. He made a mistake.
Yeah. So that's again,
I don't remember what the mistake was supposed to be, but
yeah. In somewhere in Madhya Lila, Prabhupada gives it.
No, this is Antya Lila, chapter 7.
Antya 7.
Yeah.
Or in
Lord Chaitanya is talking also to Prakashananda Saraswati in that chapter. Also.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I remember it from Adi Lila.
Chapter 25 of Madhya Lila, he's in Banaras and he meets Prakashananda. But there's some discussion
purport
of that in chapter 7 of Adi Lila too.
That particular purport.
Yes.
And Prabhupada brings in Sri Vaishnava, Sudarshan Acharya, I think. And like that's... So this is another like backup for what Sarvagya Prabhu told.
Yes.
Actually, the evidence of liberated souls is stronger than the Vedas. So liberated souls just says this is wrong in the Vedas.
And then they can contradict Vyasadeva.
Yeah.
Okay. Chidukedu Prabhu, could you find us a Mayavadi? Bring him to class? Then we'll have some interesting discussions.
It's just the one devotee that wants to learn the ashram.
Am I ready?
No, he just visited recently.
Oh.
He was for 10, 12 years in ISKCON, and then he went to study Sanskrit in Rishikesh.
Yes.
Then went to Benares, and he listened a lot of my.
He listened too much.
Yeah, and then he came and like all gods are one and so just
okay, I don't think we want to give him a hard time. I think he should rest and take prasadam.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll stop here. Thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.